Random House sets the scene in describing the Man Booker Prize-winning novel by George Saunders titled Lincoln in the Bardo. February 1862. The Civil War is less than 1 year old. The fighting has begun in earnest, and the nation has begun to realize it is in for a long, bloody struggle. Meanwhile, President Lincoln's beloved 11-year-old son, Willie, lies upstairs in the White House, gravely ill. In a matter of days, despite predictions of recovery, Willie dies and is laid to rest in a Georgetown cemetery. My poor boy, he was too good for this earth, the president says at the time. God has called him home. Newspapers report that a grief-stricken Lincoln returns alone to the crypt several times to hold his boy's body. From that seed of historical truth, George Saunders spins an unforgettable story of familial love and loss that breaks free of its realistic historical framework into a supernatural realm, both hilarious and terrifying. Lincoln in the Bardo is an astonishing feat of imagination and a bold step forward from one of the most important and influential writers of his generation. Formerly daring, generous in spirit, deeply concerned with matters of the heart, it is a testament to fiction's ability to speak honestly and powerfully to the things that really matter to us. Saunders has invented a thrilling new form that deploys a kaleidoscopic, theatrical panorama of voices to ask timeless, profound questions. George Saunders spoke with Dua Lipa about working on the story and said, I finished Lincoln in the Bardo one fall up at our house outside Oneonta, New York. I was teaching that semester and writing long hours on my non-teaching days and listening to a lot of music between sessions for two reasons, really. First, to keep my spirits up and maintain high standards. I listened to certain pieces over and over in a spirit of, I want my book to be as intense as these works, so don't let up and don't get tired. In this category, among the things I was listening to were One Sunday Morning by Wilco, Red House by Jimi Hendrix, String Quartet No. 8 in C minor by Dmitri Shostakovich, and Speed Trap Town by Jason Isbell. I listened to a second category of music for mood, really, to try to immerse myself in a certain pastoral 19th century vibe in hopes that this would translate into the book somehow. I also found that listening to orchestral or operatic pieces made me shoot higher somehow, especially in the way these works have lots of voices competing and contradicting and moving around, which was an aspiration I had for the book. In this category were pieces like Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, Lincoln Portrait, also by Copland, The Mass in B Minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, and the First Symphony of John Corigliano. That from a conversation with Dua Lipa. What's interesting is the way that the short ant food film on the storytelling of George Saunders, created by Ken Burns, Sarah Klein, and Tom Mason, illustrates Saunders' image of the reader and a story and a black box. Now, while Saunders explains, the idea I love is that a story is a kind of black box, and you're going to put the reader in there, and she's going to spend some time, and when she comes out, what's going to happen to her is something kind of astonishing, you know? It feels like the curtain's been pulled back, and she's gotten a glimpse into a deeper truth. The filmmakers illustrate that analogy by taking the viewer to an opera theater of yore with a full orchestra in front and grand burgundy curtains drawn open to reveal a single Ionic column supporting a black trunk, Saunders' black box. The top blows back, though, to release a blinding light, perhaps that deeper truth. Well, that's all very theatrical. And Saunders uses a theatrical analogy from Shakespeare as well. I think of myself really in an honorable tradition of Shakespearean fools who come into a situation and they're not that well informed or that well read necessarily. They're just kind of riffing. And the power of the Shakespearean fool is that he riffs really well. And he blunders into the truth in the spirit of trying to entertain or trying to captivate. So for me, the trick is to try to live my life in such a way that I'm not pre-shaping experiences too much. Try to go with the places that make me uncomfortable or that I think I'm sure about, but including some really just boring old banal places, and always keep my eyes and ears open. And then, in a certain way, to try not to build up a view of the world. Now, you do, of course, you do, but try not to. And then, when I get in front of a story that I'm writing, this subconscious thing kicks in, and it produces all kinds of weird gems and weird juxtapositions and tonalities that I could never have thought of in advance. So again, it's that idea that it's intuition as this conduit that provides a level of complexity that might have a sort of super truth in it. It's not necessarily linear truth or everyday truth, but there's a kind of overcharged quality that allows it to sometimes be predictive. Or what I'm working on now is sort of trying to write a piece that feels like right now. And you're sort of taking different valences that are in the culture and putting them in action. And sometimes if you do that, they will inadvertently do something that leads you to a higher understanding of things. But again, not a rational understanding, I think. There's a kind of magic in it. And I don't really even know what the function is, except I think if you read something in that spirit, something that combines the comic and the tragic, there's an instantaneous coming alive of something in your consciousness that I think is what's fun. And I suppose you could argue that it's beneficial. George Saunders in an interview with Ezra Klein in the New York Times. George Saunders is a number one New York Times best-selling author of 12 books, including Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the 2017 Man Booker Prize for Best Work of Fiction in English. His recent book, Liberation Day, is a collection of short stories, and A Swim in a Pond in the Rain is a best-selling exploration of the Russian short story. The story collection, 10th of December, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the inaugural Folio Prize in 2013. The audiobook for Lincoln in the Bardo, which featured a cast of 166 actors, was the 2018 Audi Award for Best Audiobook. He has received MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships and the Penn Malamud Prize for Excellence in the Short Story. In 2013, he was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. He's taught in the creative writing program at Syracuse University since 1996. And holds the rank of full professor, and George Saunders will be in Wilkes-Barre tomorrow. The Wilkes University English Department's Alan Hamilton Dixon's Spring Writers Series will host George Saunders, and that's at 7 o'clock, Tuesday, April 15th, at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center for the Performing Arts on South River Street, again in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public, but they ask for online registration. That's required. We had a chance to speak by phone with George Saunders. He hasn't been out on the road speaking for a year, and he's really looking forward to coming to Wilkes-Barre. And we began by asking him about Lincoln in the Bardo. We know it has been translated into Polish and Persian and many other languages, but what about now? It's being translated into music. It's going to be an opera by Missy Mazzoli, and the opera will have its premiere at the Met. So, George Saunders, what do you think?
Oh, I love the idea. And I actually heard it. Missy and Royce did a kind of a workshop in Cincinnati last year. It was just the singers and piano. So I have sort of an idea, and it's just gorgeous. You know, it's so beautiful. And Missy and I have talked about this, that I kind of had kind of an operatic model in mind when I wrote it. You know, those different voices and all taking place in one night and some big effects, you know, the angels coming in and so on. So I was really thrilled when they were interested, and then even more thrilled when I heard what they did with it. It's just like a beautiful kind of compressed version of the book, but with all that advantage of the musicals. There's one part in there that it's kind of where all the dead talk about the fact that they used to be alive, and it's so beautiful and moving. So I'm just happy as I could be about it.
They've invited you to come up while they're workshopping, and it says that you're going to be part of their Art in Action Week, Building Community Through the Arts. And for our listeners, they say you're going to be talking about the significance of books and stories and the literary arts as touchstones in our increasingly siloed and stratified social and intellectual consciousness.
Yeah.
That's something that means something to you. You believe that.
Very deeply, yeah. It's a long story, but I think we've lost the ability to empathize with one another that I think used to come sort of automatically from reading so many books and stories when we were young. So the idea that it's a virtuous thing to be able to imagine someone else's experience, even for a couple hundred pages. And also, I think, you know, when you're reading a great novel, your language centers are kind of asked to work overtime at a greater depth. And that in itself, I think, is so important in terms of making a person more receptive to other ideas. It's almost like you get a bigger opening in the top of your head for the world to come in. And I think David Brooks wrote this week about how we become kind of a stupid country. Statistically, they're measuring it, and I think reading a lot is a really good antidote to that. So I'll be expounding on that a little bit. And also, I talk a lot about the way that this works for a writer anyway is through revision. And revising a work of prose is kind of like, it's a form of saying, on the other hand, you know, or a form of saying, let me revisit this and see if I'm phoning any of this in or if any of this is lazy language. And as you do that over and over again, at least I found, the work starts to become actually more intelligent than I am, which is a blessing. It's a topic that's, now I don't know if it's sufficient. I guess that's the question. And I wouldn't want anyone to think that I'm saying, if we just read stories, there won't be any political problems. But for me, it's really the only kind of antidote that I know of. It makes me feel a little less insane to read a good book and to try to write one.
You suggest that it's easy for writers to want to be in control, but often that results in stories that feel overdetermined and so not as alive.
It's kind of a normal part of, I mean, I think as a human being, we tend to cling to concepts because that helps us with our anxiety. And we like to think that we know what the world is about because it's very frightening to think we don't. But on the other hand, if we know too well what it's about, then you just go into lockdown and you become programmatic and propagandistic. So for me, it just as a kind of anxious person, fiction has been a great way to pry open my mind once a day, you know, to come back to a bit of text and say, okay, this is what you thought yesterday. Can you say it any more clearly? Are there any better jokes? Is there any more truth in here? Are you in any way, even a little bit, on autopilot, which means, you know, you're kind of working from a solid concept. So it's really been a beautiful practice, really, over the years, you know, just to once a day sit down and say, okay, I know who I am on an everyday basis, habitually. Is there anybody, you know, it's sort of like, is there anybody in there that's more interesting? You know?
We often hear writers say, don't we, my character such and such, I started out with an idea in mind, but she or he didn't want me to go there, so I listened and I developed the character in the way the character
right.
wanted to go. But you go so far as to say that you might do that with the story itself, listen to the story and where the story is going.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think it's the same phenomenon, but basically if you're trying to say that things are this way and you write that up and something about that language is dead, then things aren't that way. You know, you write something down. If there's something flat or dead or false in it, then I just revise it, and suddenly that's the new reality. So it's almost like, I suppose, a little bit musical corollary would be, if you play a certain melody and everybody falls asleep, then maybe you want to rethink that melody until you can get a little more life in it. So I think it's what, when people talk about their characters talking to them, I think the way that a character speaks to you is through what she says and what you say about her. And if you have an initial idea about who she is and you present that and it's dead on the page, that could also be felt as her saying, no, you got me wrong, you know? So I think it's all part of the same phenomenon. But if, as a writer, I am going to offer you 5 pages as my reader, I feel like there's a contract there of kind of intimacy. Like, I want you to be enlivened by it, and I want you to believe in it. So all of the revision takes place on that basis.
And you just used the word revision, and you used it before. You do a lot of revision, and that's part of your process.
It's almost the whole process. And it's nice because that way it almost doesn't even matter what you put down the first day. There's no writer's block. You just put down anything in the faith that you can improve it. And that, for me, I think some writers aren't quite as addicted to it or as needful of it as I am. But I very seldom get it right the first time. And this approach, if you happen to get it right the first time, you just leave it. But it's enjoyable because it means you're never quite done. And you can always come back and try to make it better. But I think it may be, it's really the whole way I approach it from the beginning. I put something down and then just say, okay, now we'll work on this for another couple of years until it gets some life in it.
In doing a little reading to see what's out there to get ready to talk to you today, I found a review that begins this way. It's from a while ago. The reviewer says, it's the Los Angeles Review of Books, "Compression transforms a substance. The fundamental properties of the object can undergo such radical change that it is no longer recognizable. George Saunders does this to language. He takes words and feelings and presses them together until they reach some kind of thermodynamic phase change, a critical point in the empathy of the system." And I laugh because you were trained as a mining engineer, and isn't that what happens with coal gets under pressure?
It becomes diamond. I don't know if I've ever read that interview. That review, that's really nice. I love that. And that's very close to what it feels like. You start with something that's a little loose and coming out of your everyday mind, and then you just put it under pressure, and suddenly it starts saying more than you meant it to. But yeah, I was a geophysical engineer at the School of Mines in Colorado and worked in the oil business for a couple of years. And so there's a lot of that in my process, because when I was a student, you know, we'd have to do these long proofs, and that's very much like a story to me. You know, you start at the beginning, and if you get the first few lines right, then you're in a place to do the next and next. But the bad part is if you mess it up, you know, if there's even one moment that doesn't work, the whole proof falls apart. So I've got a bit of an obsessive relation to prose, for sure.
And you may know that the Wyoming Valley, Wilkes-Barre, where Wilkes University is located, was a very important part of the anthracite fields, the anthracite coal fields, during the Industrial Revolution and the following years.
I have a connection to coal because my father was a coal salesman in Chicago. He was on the south side, and he would go around to these different landlords, and all the buildings were heated by coal. So the story was, he would kind of somehow, by hook or by crook, get into the basement and look at the kind of boiler that it had, and then that was him preparing his sales pitch for the owner. But when we were kids, he worked for a coal company all the time, and sometimes they would, you know, they would literally, the trains would drop the coal off, and then they would shovel it into trucks, and very, very kind of like, I just kind of old school, Saul Bellow, you know, that kind of thing.
That's quite a story, because there was competition between the coal sales folks, so Dad had to be one step ahead of it.
Yeah, very much. That's why he sometimes would go into the basements of accounts he didn't quite have yet. He would find out, you know, how he could pitch it to the owner to take some business away from the other guys. So it was pretty, I think, I don't know if it was rough, but it was definitely a lot of competition and a lot of long days and nights. And I remember being out, we had moved out to the south suburbs, and on particularly cold nights, he'd sometimes get a phone call that a certain building's boiler had gone out. So, you know, the residents were outraged and angry, and he'd have to fly downtown and get it fixed. And he would go down to the basement and fix it himself, or the whole apartment building would be freezing. So it was an adventurous life.
Were you growing up in homes heated by coal, too?
No, we had moved out into a south suburb, so it was just kind of a regular old suburban house. But all the south side of Chicago was kind of slow phasing coal out. So when he was there, there were two or three really large concerns with big coal yards. You know, the trains would come through and just drop big piles of coal. And then the delivery guys would go to the house, and there was actually a coal chute in the back alley, and they'd order, you know, so much, and you'd drop it into the chute. And it was very, very manual labor kind of stuff.
There are some wonderful people who have done some writing here about what it was like and are trying to keep those memories alive.
Oh, and they should. It's so valuable to remember the ways that we have lived and the ways that we've moved on from and the heroism of those times and difficulties. And it's very, I mean, this goes back to what we said about fiction and empathy. You know, if you have a shallow view of the world, it's easy to have strong opinions. But as your knowledge gets deeper, everything becomes a little ambiguous. And especially, I think, today with social media, ambiguity gets short shrift, you know. But to hold a complex of feelings is so important, you know, to know the way it used to be and the cost of that and the advantages of that and then know how it's changed. I think it makes us more thoughtful people, more patient people, if you have a fuller understanding. But unfortunately, it makes you a little less sure of yourself, you know. But I think that's a virtue, actually.
It's a real good humility.
Yes, because it transfers into kindness. You know, if you're a person who's, I mean, this is that Lincoln and the Bardo, that's kind of the through line of that book, is the more you become aware that your suffering is not the only suffering in the world, and everybody suffers, then that makes you so much more sympathetic to other people, and so much maybe slower to act, but you act with more concern, you know, and so that kind of awareness can have the purpose of making you more sane, I think, you know, when you think about how short life is and how difficult it is. And kindness is kind of a logical conclusion of somebody who really knows the way things are, if we can do it. Because we can't be too sure of ourselves either.
You make a very good case for the importance of reading and writing in our lives, not only when you speak, but also in the stories themselves, created as they are in the evocative ways you've just described. And maybe we can't measure the impact, but readers and writers at least know it's real.
And of course, the conundrum is, I think, as I've traveled around, is that the people who will believe what we're saying right now are already readers. And people who aren't readers maybe are a little harder to win over, you know. And I think some of that is just inclination or neurology, but I think I feel like what those of us who believe in empathy and compassion and reading and education and history and truth and all that, the first thing you have to do is make sure your house is in order, do your reading, you know, do your writing, keep yourself sane, and then maybe some of that will translate out into the larger culture, we hope.
Award-winning author George Saunders speaking with us about his work in anticipation of his visit tomorrow to Northeastern Pennsylvania. The Wilkes University English Department's Alan Hamilton Dixon Spring Writers Series will host George Saunders Tuesday, April 15th at 7 in the evening at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center for the Performing Arts, 239 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public, but online registration is required. And for more information, wilkes.edu/Dixon. wilkes.edu/Dixon. That's George Saunders, who is the author of 12 books, including the novel Lincoln in the Bardo, winner of the 2017 Man Booker Prize. He's received a MacArthur Fellowship, a Guggenheim Fellowship, many other prizes. He has a degree, as we heard, in geophysics from the Colorado School of Mines. And he has taught in the creative writing program at Syracuse University since 1997. Again, George Saunders in a free presentation hosted by the Wilkes University English Department's Alan Hamilton Dixon Spring Writers Series. Tomorrow evening at 7 at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center for the Performing Arts, 239 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. For more information, on the web, wilkes.edu/Dixon, D-I-C-K-S-O-N, wilkes.edu/Dixon, D-I-C-K-S-O-N. We're hearing a piece titled Overture by the composer Missy Mazzoli. And Missy Mazzoli is the one who's been commissioned to create an opera based on Saunders' book, Lincoln in the Bardo. I had a chance to interview Dr. Rick Hoffenberg last week of Marywood University. He spent the past 25 years at Chautauqua Opera as a vocal coach and a pianist and assistant chorus director. And I asked him about this summer, what's in store, and he said, well, he had just received the score for Lincoln in the Bardo with music by Missy Mazzoli. And it is the opera, one of three, that will be workshopped this summer at Chautauqua in connection with the Metropolitan Opera in anticipation of the premiere in the 2026-2027 season, Lincoln in the Bardo. And so when Dr. Hoffenberg returns from his summer at Chautauqua, we'll be sure to talk with him about what that experience was like, workshopping Lincoln in the Bardo and preparing it for its premiere at the Metropolitan Opera, not this season, but next. The Wilkes University English Department's Alan Hamilton Dixon Spring Writers Series will host George Saunders tomorrow evening at 7, Tuesday, April 15th, at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center for the Performing Arts, 239 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public. Online registration is requested, and that's wilkes.edu/Dixon. wilkes.edu/Dixon.